following is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church in Soddy Daisy, Tennessee, featuring the teaching of Pastor Alan Rogers. In the Metro Chattanooga area, we invite you to be our guest at any of our weekly worship services or visit us online at newsalembaptist.net. Now here's Pastor Alan.
Does being a person of faith mean you'll never have a bad day? I can tell by your response that you know where I'm going with this. Far from it. In fact, sometimes seeking to walk by faith, actually, if you've been walking with Jesus for any length of time, you've discovered it. Sometimes it actually invites hard times, doesn't it? For one thing, bad days are just part of being a human being living on a fallen planet. In addition, when we're walking by faith, a lot of times we find ourselves walking against the natural currents of our society. That creates resistance, kind of like trying to walk into the surf or walking upstream. Finally, there's this, that sometimes God actually allows difficult times to come into our lives as a way of strengthening our faith and testing our faith. As James, one of the leaders in the very first church, wrote, "Consider it all joy, my brothers, when you encounter different trials, knowing the testing of your faith produces endurance." So if being a person of faith doesn't protect us from difficult days, what's the value of walking by faith? Well, it's great in every way. First of all, being a person of faith can have a positive effect in how you respond to some of those difficulties and discouragements. Second, walking by faith can also provide you with resources to help you cope with those disappointments and those difficult days. And then aligning your heart towards God's heart can actually determine how you're going to come out and end up on the other side of those difficult times. We see this illustrated in a sequence of events that are described in 1 Samuel chapters 27 through chapter 30. And I invite you to turn to chapter 27 right now as we look and see the lives of two men laid side by side. One was a person whose heart leaned towards God. The other had a heart that leaned away from God. Both of these men suffered periods characterized by anxiety and uncertainty. Both made choices that resulted in moral compromise and negative consequences. One came through this experience restored with a new lease on life. The other, sadly, lost his life as a result of some of the choices he had made. So let's walk our way through this. And as the old song says, we got a long way to go and a short time to get there. So let's lace up and hit the ground running as we look at what we can learn from these desperate times, these dubious choices, and one act of deliberate repentance. The first thing I want you to take away from this message today is this. Even people after God's own heart can experience moments of doubt. Look at chapter 27, verse 1. "Then David said to himself, 'Now I'll perish one day by the hand of Saul. There's nothing better for me than to escape into the land of the Philistines. Saul then will despair of searching for me anymore in all the territory of Israel, and I'll escape from his hand.'" So chapter 27 opens with David, the future king of Israel, having survived yet another close call with Saul, the then current king of Israel, who wanted to see David dead. We can read about that in chapter 26 if you want to go back and look at it on your own. But as this chapter opens, we find David distressed, depressed, and suffering a moment of doubt. Wait a minute, Pastor, say it ain't so. Doesn't the Bible call David a man after God's own heart? Surely David's faith would have insulated him from having those dark thoughts. Hey, listen to me. Even the person with the greatest amount of faith is still a human being and therefore subject to depression and doubt. Friday is the 31st, it's Halloween. It's also known as Reformation Day, to celebrate the day that Martin Luther posted those 95 theses on the door of the Wittenberg Church, kicked off the Protestant Reformation. A lot of people don't know this. You know, they think of Luther as a great Bible scholar and a great theologian, but Luther was also known to suffer from periods of intense doubt and depression. Luther sometimes described these episodes as wrestling with the devil. There's a letter he wrote to a former student who was having his own struggles with depression. And this is what Luther told him. "You say that the temptation is heavier than you can bear, and that you fear it will so break and beat you down as to drive you to despair and blasphemy." You ever been there? Luther goes on, "I know this wile of the devil. If he cannot break a person in his first attack, he tries by persevering to wear him out and weaken him until the person falls and confesses himself beaten." Another great figure of the past, Charles Haddon Spurgeon, 19th century, a British pastor who was known around the world as the Prince of Preachers. He's estimated to have preached the gospel to over 10 million people during his lifetime. Spurgeon, this great pastor who preached to thousands of people every Sunday there in London, was known to suffer from bouts of depression. Spurgeon once wrote, "I have suffered many times from severe sickness and frightful mental depression, seeking almost to despair. Almost every year I've laid aside for a season, for flesh and blood cannot bear the strain, at least such flesh and blood as mine." Then he goes on to say, "I believe, however, the affliction was necessary to me and has answered salutary ends." So Spurgeon looked at those times of depression in his life, and he saw that as a tool God was using to build his faith. Being a person of faith does not excuse one from suffering dark moments, though it should impact how we respond to those moments. Now, according to the text, unfortunately, David did some things that only exacerbated his situation. First of all, David let his internal dialogue run wild. What does it say? David said to himself, right? Literally, in the Hebrew, it's "he said in his heart." And I've told you before, this old expression, "just listen to your heart," that is some of the worst advice you can ever get. Our hearts are so messed up. They will steer you so wrong. But David is saying in his heart, he allowed himself to get too much in his own head. He overthought this. Now, if we're not careful, we do the exact same thing, don't we? Our internal dialogue can inflame our anxieties. You notice what's missing from this dialogue? Did anybody catch this besides me? Who did David not take his problems to? There's no mention here of him turning to the Lord. Say, "God, what's your problem with this? How can you solve this?" So David let his own internal dialogue run wild. He looked inside instead of looking up. David also focused on the negative. He said, "I will perish one day by the hand of Saul." Now today we may say something like, "Man, one day Saul's going to be the death of me." You ever been in a situation like that where you just felt, "Man, if I don't just change something, this is going to kill me." Isn't it curious that David was more focused on the threat posed by Saul than all the times God had delivered him from the hand of Saul? Isn't it so hard for us sometimes? When we're facing a problem, we focus on the problem instead of all the ways God has blessed us in the past. We focus on the mountain when we should be focusing on the mountain mover. David also decided on a human-based solution. He's not looking up. He is looking straight horizontal here. He's just looking and saying, "How can I do something to fix this situation?" He says, "You know what? I got an idea. There's nothing better for me than to escape to the land of the Philistines." Think about that logic for a moment. Had God called David to be the king of the Philistines? No, he was called and anointed to be king of the land of Israel. How in the world is he going to be king over Israel if he's hiding out with Israel's chief enemy? Now, as a pastor, I totally understand the impulse David expressed in this statement. Earlier this month, this church celebrated my 16th year of serving as your pastor. A lot of people might look at today and look at trends and say, "Man, that's a long time for a pastor to stay at one church." And you're right. These days it is. There's a reason today that a lot of pastors barely make it 3 to 5 years at a given church. And we could go into a lot of reasons for that, but let me say simply, those who don't know better might assume that working in a church is one step removed from heaven. Boy, is that wrong. There's times it's more like the opposite. Because the reality is, in church ministry, a lot of times we're dealing with people. Okay, I don't know if you figured this out, but even in church, people come in varying levels of maturity, both spiritual and emotional. So ministry can be really messy. It can be a grind. And after about 3 years of running through that buzzsaw, I know some guys look around and say, "Man, you know, I think the grass may be a little greener over there." I mean, we all face that temptation. When you're going through a difficult time, isn't it natural for us to start looking around saying, hey, where can I go to get out from under this? Maybe if I change jobs, maybe if I change neighborhoods, maybe if I change my friends, to get out away from this situation. There's one thing I've learned in my years of ministry is this. Sometimes you have to be willing to walk through some dark valleys if you want to get to the mountain peak on the other side. David is looking for an escape here. See, dwelling on our doubts can lead us to make dubious choices. So without consulting God, David leads his 600 fighting men, plus their wives and their children, into the territory of Israel's chief enemy. Verse 2, so David arose and crossed over, he and the 600 men who were with him, to Achish the son of Maach, the king of Gath. And David lived with Achish at Gath, he and his men, each with his household, even David with his two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail the Carmelitess, Nabal's widow. And it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, so he no longer searched for them. So they didn't just go into Philistine territory. They went to Gath. You might remember the hometown of one of David's chief enemies. Remember a guy by the name of Goliath? And those of you who've been with us for a few weeks, you may remember, hey, wait a minute. Didn't David try this once before? Yeah, when David first had to flee from Saul for his life, he ran into Philistine territory all on his own, and he went to Gath to try to sell himself as a mercenary to King Achish. And at the time, some of the Philistines recognized him, said, hey, that's the guy that killed Goliath. And they started talking among themselves, and David started to get a little nervous. So he actually had to pretend he was insane so that the Philistines would drive him away instead of just killing him outright. Now here he is years later, returning to Gath. But this time he's coming at the head of a small army. Perhaps David thought the Philistines might take him a little more seriously at this point. And he offers himself as a vassal to this Philistine king. Now, because of the size of David's entourage, the king of Gath gave David a village named Ziklag, which was located near the border with Israel. Now you can imagine what it'd be like to have, and there's probably at least 1,000 people with David, maybe if not 2,000. Imagine what would happen in our community if 1,000 or 2,000 people just showed up overnight. And what a strain that would put on resources. They show up in this city, and Achish says, guys, good to see you, but you can't hang around here. I tell you what, I got an unused village down here in the south. You guys are welcome to it. Ironically, Ziklag was supposed to be an Israelite village. It was mentioned in Joshua in the list of cities that the Israelites were supposed to capture, but for some reason they had never actually taken control of this. Or at some point it passed into Philistine control, and then after David takes control of it, it remains an Israelite town from that point on. But it's located in the south, away from Gath, and David's decision to seek refuge with the Philistines may have given him a brief respite from Saul's pursuit, but it also set in motion a chain of events that would put David in a pretty precarious position. See, little compromises often lead to bigger compromises. Once he was settled in Ziklag, David led his men to raid Canaanite settlements out in the Negev desert. In verse 8, now David and his men went up and raided the Geshurites and the Gerzites and the Amalekites, for they were the inhabitants of the land from ancient times, as you come to Shur, even as far as the land of Egypt. Now the people mentioned in this verse are among those that the Israelites had been instructed to wipe out under Joshua when they first entered the promised land. God said, just wipe these people out. And pockets of these people still existed in this wilderness south of Ziklag in the Negev desert. David and his men ruthlessly slaughtered the inhabitants there and claimed their livestock as booty. In verse 9, David attacked the land and did not leave a man or woman alive. And he took away the sheep, the cattle, the donkeys, the camels, and the clothing. Now, we read that, and that sounds, man, that's brutal. That's awful. That's like genocide. What is going on here? Let me just caution you before you judge David to remember that these Canaanites were not very nice people. There's a reason God had told the Israelites to wipe them out. And God had been very patient. He had waited hundreds of years to give these folks a chance to get their act together, as we read in Joshua. But they persisted in their idolatry and immorality and their unjust treatment of the people around them. And so God finally said, okay, time's up. They've had enough time to get their act together. They're out of here. And he told his people, wipe them out. So David is only following the instructions God had given here. The main problem with these raids was not that David was wiping out Canaanites, but that David felt the need to lie to his Philistine host about what he was doing. Verse 10, now Achish said, "Where have you made a raid today?" And David said, "Against the Negev of Judah, against the Negev of the Jeremelites, and against the Negev of the Kenites." Achish is asking, "What have you been doing?" And David had to tell him, "I'm attacking my own people, or I'm attacking the people of my allies." Now, the ruthlessness of the slaughter also meant David and his men had left no witnesses who could come back and tell what was really going on. But David's having to commit untruth here to tell the Philistines that he was really attacking his people and not the Canaanites. But there's even a bigger problem here. The bigger problem with David's choices is that they placed him in a position in which the Philistines might expect him to actually engage in hostilities against his own people. I mean, after all, he's already told them he's doing it, right? Achish is so impressed with David's story, he makes him his bodyguard. Down into verse 12, chapter 28. Now it came about in those days, the Philistines gathered their armed camp for war to fight against Israel. And Achish said, "Know that you shall go out with me in the camp, you and your men." David said to Achish, "Very well, you shall know what your servant can do." And Achish said to David, "Very well, I will make you my bodyguard for life." In Hebrew, it literally means, "I will make you the keeper of my head." Now, if you remember the story of Goliath, there's a certain irony to this. Because what happened to Goliath's head when David took care of it? Off with it. So I'm sure the scribe who wrote this got a big chuckle out of putting those words down. But as the bodyguard of Achish, David and his men will be expected to accompany Achish in battle. What are the Philistines getting ready to do? They are mustering their forces from their five strongholds, and they are getting ready to march on the people of Israel. And as Achish's bodyguard, David is going to be expected, he and his men are going to be expected to be right there in the thick of it, fighting their own people, the people he's supposed to eventually be king over. See, when we begin to make little compromises, we often have no idea where those little steps may lead us. And if we persist in pushing God away, we may find him absent when we need him the most. Now, we get into chapter 28 and the scene shifts. As the Philistines are mustering their troops, all of a sudden the focus shifts over to Saul and what Saul's doing. And in the face of the looming battle, Saul begins to get quite anxious for a word from the Lord. In verse 5, when Saul saw the camp of the Philistines, he was afraid and his heart trembled greatly. Now, as we mentioned previously, Saul's heart was not really inclined towards the Lord, okay? Saul wanted to enjoy the blessings of God, but he didn't want to submit to the authority of God. Saul only wanted to hear from God when God's words comforted him, not when they challenged him. Saul was like a lot of people today who are only concerned with God when they want something from God. If you have no time for God until you need a favor, hey, why should you expect him to answer when you call? But that's what Saul was doing. Saul was getting the silent treatment from God because for years, Saul had shut himself off from all the usual ways that God spoke to his people. In verse 6, when Saul inquired of the Lord did not answer him, either by dreams or by Urim or by prophets. You see, Saul had rejected God's commands for years. Saul had killed all of God's priests, except for the one that escaped to David. Now, a Urim is a special stone that was kept by Israel's priest in a vest called the ephod, and it was a way of trying to discern God's will. You would ask a yes or no question, and you'd reach in and pull out one of these stones at random, and that would tell you what God was leading them to do. Now, you don't have a Urim and Thummim today, so I don't really advise necessarily following this procedure, but that's the way they were instructed to do it. But in order to do that, you got to have a priest. You remember what Saul did to all the priests? He killed them all because he thought they were helping David, except for one guy who escaped and was now living in David's camp. Saul also ignored all of God's prophets, including Samuel, whom he had disobeyed time and time again. So why should he expect to get a word from the Lord? To really understand where Saul's heart was, look at where he turned in his desperation to get a word from the Lord. In verse 7, Saul said to his servants, "Seek for me a woman who is a medium, that I may go to her and inquire of her." And his servant said to him, "Behold, there's a woman who is a medium at Endor." Now, the law of Moses strictly forbade God's people from consulting what are called necromancers. Those are people who claim to have the ability to speak with the dead. In Deuteronomy 18, verses 10 through 12, listen to what God says about this. There shall not be found among you anyone who makes his son or daughter pass through the fire, one who uses divination, one who practices witchcraft, or one who interprets omens, or a sorcerer, or one who casts a spell, or a medium, or a spiritist, or one who calls up the dead. For whoever does these things is detestable to the Lord. And because of these detestable things, the Lord your God will drive them out before you. So tell me again, how does God feel about people who practice necromancy? Not very happy with them. Keep that in mind the next time you're tempted to check your horoscope or consult with a Ouija board, okay? That's not how God wants his people to do things. He wants them to come to him. Now, to his credit, early in his reign, as we're told in this passage, Saul had conducted a campaign to rid Israel of people who practice such dark arts. Maybe he was trying to keep Samuel on his good side. We don't know. But at one point in his campaign, he had run all those people off. But now, he's desperate. He needs to hear from God. So he seeks help from a source that God had condemned. How does that make sense? It's a sign of Saul's desperation that he had to disguise himself and sneak behind enemy lines to consult with this woman. Okay? Endor was on the other side of the battle line. So here on the eve of this big battle with the Philistines, Saul's actually having to disguise himself and sneak into Philistine territory to seek this woman out. Now, what do you think is worse, okay? A temptation that's right in front of you, or a temptation you have to go out of your way to pursue? Saul's having to go out of his way. It's almost like God put these roadblocks and said, don't go there, don't go there, don't go there. And what do? We blow right through those because we just got to have what we got to have, right? So Saul meets with this woman, and this is a much longer story. We're not going to go through all the details here, but as I say sometimes, this is a sermon for another Sunday. But there's some fascinating aspects to this story. He asked the witch woman to put him in touch with the soul of prophet Samuel in verse 11. And I said, we could spend a lot of time exploring some interesting questions with this episode, but that's for another time. For our purposes, let the record show that much to everyone's surprise, including the woman who was supposedly calling forth his spirit, Samuel apparently showed up. Verse 15. Then Samuel said to Saul, why have you disturbed me by bringing me up? The shade of Samuel proceeded to affirm the word of judgment that had been delivered against Saul when Samuel was still alive. Samuel castigated Saul for wanting to hear from God after all the years he had spent pushing God away. Verse 16, Samuel said, why then do you ask me, since the Lord has departed from you and has become your adversary? He reminded Saul that God had promised to tear the kingdom away from him and give it to David because of Saul's disobedience. And then in verse 19, Samuel predicted the Philistines were going to defeat the Israelites in the impending battle. And if that were not bad enough, listen to what he says to Saul. Verse 19, moreover, the Lord will also give over Israel along with you into the hands of the Philistines. Therefore, tomorrow, you and your sons will be with me. If a ghost tells you, hey, guess what? You're getting ready to join me. Again, we could argue whether this is a real apparition or what. That's another story. But that would be a little unnerving, wouldn't it? You will be with me. Indeed, the Lord will give over the army of Israel into the hand of the Philistines. The takeaway from this episode is this, okay? When we spend a lifetime rejecting God, how can we be surprised when he rejects us? In contrast to David, Saul's heart was always inclined away from God, not towards him. Saul spent the majority of his reign treating God like an accessory, not an authority. As Romans chapter 1 reminds us, if we persist in choosing our sin over God repeatedly, eventually the day's going to come when God's going to, in the words of Paul, give us over to what we've been pursuing. If you've persisted in living your life as if God does not exist, the day may come when God will eventually let you experience what it means to exist outside of his presence for eternity. And let me let you in on a little clue. According to Genesis chapter 1, you were made to have a connection with your Creator. and to be separated from the very thing you were made for eternity, that would be a terrible fate indeed. On the other hand, God providentially directs the paths of those who honor him. We get into verse 29, the scene shifts back to David. And even though David had temporarily lost sight of God, God had never lost sight of him. He knew exactly where David was at. And in his providence, God arranged for David to be excused from having to battle his own people. David came riding into the Philistine encampment with Achish in chapter 29, verse 2. And despite Achish's efforts to vouch for David, the other Philistines said, "Hey, we know who this guy is." Verse 4, the commanders of the Philistines were angry with him, and the commanders of the Philistines said to him, "Make this man go back, that he may return to his place where you've assigned him. Do not let him go down to battle with us, or in the battle he may become an adversary to us. For with what could this man make himself acceptable to his Lord? Would it not be the heads of these men?" Hey, what are all these Hebrews doing here? We're getting ready to go fight them. You're going to take these guys with us into battle? What's to stop them in the middle of the battle from switching sides and stabbing us in the back? Literally. So Achish's partners here didn't want anything to do with David and his men. And so Achish reluctantly orders David and his men to return to their home base in Ziklag. Now, that was a providential move of God. It prevented David from having to take up arms against his own people. But there's also another aspect of God's providence in display here in this. We get to chapter 30, verses 1 through 5. And then it happened. David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day. So it took them 3 days to get back to Ziklag. And when they got there, they found that the Amalekites had made a raid on the Negev and on Ziklag and had overthrown Ziklag and burned it with fire. And they took captive the women and all who were in it, both small and great, without killing anyone, and carried them off and went on their way. In the Hebrew, that word carry them off literally means driving them like cattle. Okay? When David and his men came to the city, behold, it was burned with fire, and their wives and their sons and their daughters had been taken captive. Then David and the people who were with him lifted their voices and wept until there was no more strength for them to weep. So they make this three-day journey from the front lines. They get back home. They think they're safe. And somebody says, "Hey, is that smoke?" And they get to the city and they find it torched and everyone gone. Now you say, "Wait a minute, how is that an act of God's providence?" It's this. If David and his men had stayed with the Philistine army, the Amalekites would have had more time to get away with their prisoners. And David and his men most likely would never have seen their families again. David and his men would have lost all chance of recovering their families. But since they were sent back from the battle, God provided a window for David to pursue and to recover what he'd lost. Keep this lesson in mind. As David would write in Psalm 37:23, "The steps of a man are established by the Lord, and he delights in his way." That barrier or that setback that you're encountering right now, that could be God's way of protecting you from something worse. Keep that in mind. God looks out for those who honor him. He acts providentially to guide them. Even sometimes when we're not looking for him, he still arranges things to nudge us in the direction that he wants to lead us. God also responds to those who deliberately seek him. David was feeling a lot of anxiety over the loss of his family, as well as the disappointment of his men. Look what happens in verse 6. He's grieving over the loss of his family. But moreover, David was greatly distressed because the people spoke of stoning him. For all the people were embittered, each one because of his sons and daughters. Who were they blaming for this debacle? David was on the hot seat. It's kind of like being an SEC football coach who loses to your chief rival. They start planting the moving van outside your home. David's feeling that heat. And then in the heat of that moment, with that pressure coming down on him, guess what? David finally does what he should have done in the first place. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. David turned to the Lord. David sought godly guidance. Verse 7, David said to Abiathar the priest, the son of Ahimelech, "Please bring me the ephod. Remember, the ephod was where they kept those stones that were used for determining God's will. So David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I pursue this band? Shall I overtake them?" And he said to him, "Pursue, for you will surely overtake them. You will surely rescue all." So David sought out godly guidance. It's what he should have done in the first place. David also set out to be obedient. So David went, he and the 600 men who were with him, and came to the brook Besor, where those who were those left behind remained. And then David pursued, he and 400 men, for 200 were too exhausted to cross the brook Besor and remained behind. So David sets out to be obedient. And on the way, in the middle of this stress, David demonstrates grace and generosity. How many times in this story of David have we come across those themes? Grace and generosity. David does this a couple of ways. First of all, he demonstrates grace towards a captured Amalekite slave. And you can read about that in verses 11 through 15. There was an Egyptian who had been a slave to an Amalekite, and he had gotten sick and had been left behind. It shows you how much the Amalekites cared about their slaves. But he had been left behind to die in the desert. And even though this slave had most likely participated in the raid, David treated him with kindness instead of torture. How many of us would have been tempted to do, what was the show with Kiefer Sutherland, 24? How many of us would have been tempted to just go all out and start pulling the guy's fingernails out to get the answer? You know, we got to find our families. Where's the pliers? Where's the car battery? No, that's not. David fed, he had the guy fed. They fed him Fig Newtons and honey, trying to sugar this guy up to revive him and restore him. And David promised to protect the slave in exchange for his assistance in tracking down the raiders. David also demonstrated grace and generosity towards the men who stayed behind. You know, we talked about these 200 men who stayed behind at the brook. Well, David and 400 of the men keep pressing on. They find the Amalekite camp. They attack it. The Amalekites are all drunk and partying and you know, celebrating their good fortune. David and his men swoop in and wipe them out, except for a couple hundred guys who got on their camels and rode out. They recapture not only all of their families, they also all the other loot these Amalekites had gathered up in their raids throughout the territory. So all of a sudden, David and his men come into a lot of wealth. They come back to the brook to pick up the men who've been left behind. And remember, these guys are there because it took them 3 days to get from the front lines to Ziklag. They're exhausted. It's a long, hard, dry journey. Some of these guys are worn out. But they get back, and after the Amalekites are defeated and the families recovered, there's some people in David's camp who took part in the battle who refused to share the spoils with those who had stayed behind. Verse 22. Then all the wicked and worthless men among those who went with David said, "Because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we've recovered, except to every man his wife and children, that they may lead them and depart." So you know what? Those guys, they didn't go fight with us. They made us do all the work. They don't deserve any of this. Give them their families back, but then let's just drive them out of here. We don't need them anymore. How many of us would be tempted to adopt that kind of mindset? Was that what David did? Now look at verse 23. Then David said, "You must not do so, my brothers, with what the Lord has given us, who has kept us and delivered us into our hand, the band that came against us. For who would listen to you in this matter? For as his share is who goes down to the battle, so his share shall be with he who stays by the baggage. They shall share alike. So it has been for this day forward. He made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel to this day." So David steps in to promote a policy of generosity. Instead of selfishly clinging to the blessings God had given him, he freely shared those blessings with others. And once again, we see David imitating the heart of God by offering grace to those who hadn't earned it. This is exactly how God deals with us. "For by grace you've been saved through faith, and that not of yourselves. It is the gift of God, not as a result of works, so that no one can boast." You and I don't deserve salvation, but God offers it to us through Christ anyway. If you want to be a person after God's own heart, if you want to align your heart with His, then cultivate a spirit of grace and generosity towards other people. Because God blesses those who make a practice of blessing others. In the last few verses of this, we see David take this incredible bounty he's received, and he begins to send gifts out to other leaders in Israel. By sharing the blessings instead of hoarding them, David was creating goodwill that would pay dividends later when he was trying to unite this country back together after Saul's death. As David's son Solomon would later write in Proverbs 11:25, "The generous man will be prosperous, and he who waters will himself be watered." Practice generosity. Practice grace. Now, in this sequence of events, I told you we're going to cover a lot of ground. In this sequence of events, we see two people contrasted. Two paths that we can choose from. Okay? One path is characterized by a heart that's inclined towards God. The other is a heart that is inclined away from God and rejects His authority. And that heart is characterized by selfishness and stubbornness. That path, inclined away from God, leads to death. The other path, the heart that's inclined towards God, is ready to admit its mistakes. It's ready to repent of its errors when confronted with them, and ready to seek God's guidance and obey His commands. That heart is characterized by gratefulness towards God that gets expressed to generosity and grace towards other people. Let me ask you a question this morning. Which of those hearts does yours resemble? Which path are you walking today?
This program is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church. Music courtesy of Jason Shaw at audionautix.com. If you enjoy this program, we would love to hear from you. Email us at info@newsalembaptist.net. Thank you for listening.